Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Courtney Dominguez.
Tim Ramsey is the Chief Information Security Officer and Vice President of Information Security at World Fuel Services, a Fortune 100 energy solutions provider. As World Fuel's first CISO, Tim created the vision, mission, strategy, policy framework, and governance structure for the Global Information Security Program. His focus has been creating an enterprise culture of security, modernizing the cyber controls portfolio, and leveraging the security program as a competitive differentiator. Tim led the organization in achieving ISO 27001 certification, adopting the NIST cybersecurity framework, lowering third-party risk, hardening the identity infrastructure, implementing secure code development, and improving threat detection response capabilities. Tim reports to the Chief Operating Officer and collaborates with peers on strategy, culture, metrics, talent, budget, and agile practices. Prior to World Fuel, Tim was the University of Miami's first CISO and AVP of IT, HIPAA Security Officer, and Chair of the Clinical Research Electronic Data Committee. Prior to the CISO role, Tim served as UM's AVP of IT Infrastructure for more than a decade. While at UM, Tim was an adjunct computer information systems professor and was nominated twice by his students as Faculty Member of the Year. Tim earned a BBA in finance from Florida International University, an MBA in computer information systems from UM, a certificate degree in telecommunications, and holds active CISSP, CISM, and AWS certifications. Tim Ramsey, thank you so much for spending time with me today. This is going to be a great conversation.
Oh, Courtney, I've been looking forward to it.
Good. Well, Tim, you are the CISO and VP of World Fuel Services in Doral, Florida. So can you tell everybody a little bit about, you know, what you do for World Fuel?
Oh, yes. Well, Courtney, I just had my four-year anniversary. And
God, it feels like 10.
It does. That's the way it works in cyber. But I look after all of our security program. I report into our COO and report to the board on managing our overall information security defense environment, all of our applications, our infrastructure, our cloud platforms, and basically try to protect us from the hackers and insider threat. And it's a very, very critical position for a company like World Fuel.
Yeah, especially being a global company, you know, you deal with so much every day. So I know I appreciated all of your efforts when I was at World Fuel, and I know there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. So, and this is such a great topic, right? Because there's so much going on in the world right now. It feels like every day there's some kind of news headline, you know, citing some kind of cyber attack or phishing attack. I read one statistic just this week that said that there have been more cyber attacks in the past 6 months than all of 2019, which is really hard to believe. So what's leading that? What are your thoughts on what's leading, you know, the rise of cyber attacks, and what are some of the most common threats that you're seeing?
Well, Courtney, it's not just a quantity of cyber attacks. You're absolutely right. There's been a 148% increase in ransomware, a 600% increase in COVID-19 themed phishing email, a 630% cloud-based types of attacks, 238% increase in attacks on banks. So yeah, the quantity's up, but also what's happening is the quality, the intensity, the sophistication of the attacks has been increasing. At Twitter, they had a recent highly publicized attack that many people saw, where Bill Gates, Donald Trump, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos were all perceived to have sent out some type of email that or a tweet that they never sent. And when they investigated, it wasn't that any of those gentlemen gave up their Twitter password and were hacked. It was IT professionals back at Twitter that gave up their credentials that were then used by the attacker to send out emails in their name. But it started with a phishing attack, and actually phishing meaning voice over the phone. That's how these IT professionals with privileged access were compromised. The interesting thing is that for Floridians, anyway, where we're at here in Miami, this was an 18-year-old young man over on the west coast of Florida in the Tampa area. But he planned it and pulled it off. But it just shows how really anyone with a good story and a planful approach can dupe people that really should know better. So,
and that can happen to any company.
It can. But in the past, we've all tried to, and we do this at World Fuel. We fish our people because we want everyone to pay attention. But the way that qualitatively the attackers are going after people with privileged access means that they know who to go after and how that might pay off more than some rank and file employee who falls susceptible to a phishing email. Another qualitative difference is what's happened in ransomware. Time was in 2013 with CryptoLocker. If you ever had that on your computer, you'd probably see a screen show up that said, please pay me $500 in Bitcoin and I'll give you the decryption key for getting your data back. Well, now what's happened, and you saw this with Xerox, is even if you have really good backups and you could normally tell the attacker, go pound sand, I have backups, I'm not paying your extortion, they've made copies of your data and they say, listen, I know you could probably back up your data, but we have your data. And if you don't pay us the extortion, we're going to send an email to the state attorney general's office and let them know that we have all of your data and we're going to publish it and humiliate you on the internet and destroy your reputation with all your customers. So instead of it just being about getting your data back, it's now about complete reputational damage. And what that actually was a scenario at Xerox. What's more important is that even if you pay the ransom, and what we've heard from people like Mandy is that when you do pay the ransom, they do give you the decryption key, but they make no promises that they won't come back.
Right.
And in many cases they do, and we'll try to extort you again.
Well, they know they got you the first time, right? So what's to say they're not going to, you know, get you a second time? So that makes sense that companies, you know, would be attacked once and then would be susceptible to multiple attacks.
Yeah.
So Tim, this is a unique year. We've got not only the pandemic, we've got a U.S. presidential election going on. So it's kind of the perfect storm for this year of just major events happening. So let's discuss the pandemic first. It's obviously had a huge impact on society, right? I mean, all over the world, people have felt this. And we're also seeing cyber threats as individuals and organizations try to take advantage of the situation. We've seen attacks on school systems. We saw here in Dade County, healthcare entities and charitable organizations. So how has the COVID-19 pandemic really impacted the landscape of cybersecurity for maybe some of the more vulnerable entities that maybe people haven't focused on because cyber threats probably weren't a huge issue for them in the past?
Right. Now, COVID-19 has presented the attackers with a wide range of opportunities beyond the increase in the phishing attacks, which is enormous by itself. You see a lot of fake websites now promising a cure for COVID-19 if you'll, you know, just give them your credit card, or fake treatments, fake cures. There's fake websites with data tracking it, but if you go there, they're laced with malware, and you can become infected by going to these bad websites. If you were trying to check on your stimulus check, there are fake websites out there trying to steal your personal information. Please enter your social security number, and we'll give you an update on where your stimulus check is at. And work from home. Now that we're all working from home, it's presented yet another attack vector, because people aren't behind their corporate firewalls. Right. And if they don't log in through their VPN, they're basically traversing the public internet. And you know, remote workers have caused security breaches in 20% of organizations, according to Malwarebytes, that's just recently released. And beyond just work from home, all of our children are studying from home.
Right.
And trying to entertain themselves at home. There's been a 30% increase in gaming. And there, sometimes the fastest computer in the home is mom or dad's work computer.
Yep.
And so if they go onto their computer and they go to a gaming site or their password's been stolen, it now becomes an attack vector for a bad actor to get into a home network through one of the children who may be using the iPad or using the laptop. But the gaming passwords in and of themselves present an opportunity to get malware on machines where a keylogger could be installed or to have ransomware impact somebody's home computer or work computer. And if you haven't protected your router password, it may be an area of compromise too, where they could get to your own personal accounts in another way where they couldn't before. So that's where a lot of the attack focus is on now, is the home network.
I've heard two stories in the past week of friends whose children's Roblox accounts were compromised. Their passwords were taken, and you know, there wasn't any ransomware or anything involved. But both times they were, you know, both times they were compromised. And when you think about, you know, your kids, they're not used to creating those super secure passwords. You know, it's your pet's name, it's their best friend's name, it's their own name, it's 1234. You know, it's not. They're just not at that same level where they even think that this stuff is going to happen. You get one password for a kid and they're going to use not unlike adults. I mean, we do it too, right? Where you use the same password across multiple accounts. I'm sure you don't, but the rest of us, you know, that don't think about those kinds of threats every day, you know, probably do that. So you get one password and now you can get into your Amazon account, your, you know, God forbid your Ring application. I mean, all kinds of really scary things where there's a lot of data out there for people to be had and are not going to do good things with it. So, you know, it's an important point to really think about, especially not only just working from home, but your point about kids and gaming and really educating them as well.
Right. You know, it's the hackers assume that people are using the same password everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not like, let's guess, because humans can only remember so much. And if they do change them, they change them in maybe some very unsophisticated ways, adding maybe a character here or there, and very susceptible to being cracked once they know your general approach to, you know, to passwords.
But, right.
We didn't think about that when we were in the workplace, whether our children, what they're doing at in the home in the other room, you know, really could impact our work. But it is one and the same network. And at while at work, we wouldn't have thought much about it either. But you look at all the ways our homes are becoming more digital.
Absolutely.
From the nanny cam to the digital smart garage door, the digital lock, the digital fridge, the smart toaster, the smart
thermostat.
And, you know, those things, you know, may not necessarily be filled with data that you would care about. But what we've also seen is that people who don't protect those are open to being, I guess the word would be digital vandalism or harassment, maybe in a bad breakup between a boyfriend, girlfriend, or harassing them by making the lights go off and on, turning off the heat, turning up the air conditioner, making the garage door go up and down, turning on the sprinklers. And so it's a call to secure your home digitally and not just presume that, you know, you're that root password that was initially created on the router is secure.
Well, not to mention your car too, right?
So
everything at this point has got, you know, lots of computers and things in it where, you know, malicious people can really take advantage of a situation, especially with so many of us enhancing our homes right now because we are at home. You know, we're doing those smart automation technologies for your home because it makes life easier. So lots of people are making those types of investments. And then, you know, you've got your car sitting outside or in your garage which is tied into your, you know, garage door. So it's all being tied together, which is very convenient, but also can be very scary as well.
Right. And that's why it's just so important to be aware of what can be done, and then remediate that, block that from being able to happen by isolating that. And the best way is with passwords right now and password keepers. But we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute.
Yeah, perfect. So let's talk about the election, right? So it's a big year for the United States as we go to the polls. And we were chatting a little bit ago, you know, you've already got your ballot in, which is right on, right? And mine will be going shortly. So, you know, we've seen in past elections that the obviously a big election and a pivotal moment for the United States is encouraging cyber attacks from entities that are looking to really just meddle in the election. So there have been a number of reports of Russia and China attempting to influence our election again. You mentioned the Twitter hack already, right, with the political accounts being hacked. So what are some of the biggest, you know, threats and risks to the upcoming election?
So we have 6,600 local county clerks and election commissioners that are trying to manage a database of voters. And that's the area of initial focus of potential risk, where those databases could be attacked, modified, or you could use ransomware to just lock them up so that if someone showed up at the precinct on election day, that you might not be able to verify who Courtney Dominguez is and is she eligible to vote or not. And in 2016, that actually happened, according to the research done by the Mueller report, that the Russians were doing that. So the voting machines, by and large, where you go up and you vote, they're offline, they're air-gapped, meaning they're not connected to a network. And whatever you're voting on, whoever you're picking, that's locally stored. But after that's all done and you start to collect all the data, that's where there's risk. That's where the fun can begin for the cyber actors. How does that data go from these 6,600 local municipalities to collapse into one state that is going to then be reported out to the media? And is there an opportunity for that to be compromised? There's a University of Michigan professor named Alex Halderman and his 48 students demonstrated how they were able to remotely gain control to a voting machine. Wow. And change the data, the vote was on it. But for those systems that are offline, that's probably not the point of incursion. It's probably somewhere else when the data is being tabulated. And is that capable of being disrupted? You're right. It's China may have a incentive to try to swing the election towards a Joe Biden, Russia, maybe Donald Trump, who knows. Mm-hmm. But there's another possible goal in election tampering, and that's to make it so that we might not know who won, and to try to foment chaos, to try to create more turmoil, more strife, more enmity between red and blue states. And so if you could, you know, create a ransomware situation where certain precincts didn't even know how the vote turned out, that would definitely fall into the category of, we succeeded because now one really knows who won. So that definitely raises the stakes here for every single municipality to pay attention to protecting each election, and also for there to be dual control, because it's such a heated election that the opportunity for anyone along the way who has deeply held opinions about the election to not be unilaterally able to influence the tabulation or the reporting.
We thought we got past our hanging Chad situation a few years ago, right? And now here we are. Here we are. May not be hanging Chads this time, but a whole different issue.
Please don't let it be Florida.
I don't know. We have a way. We have our ways around doing things down here. So hopefully this one will be a smooth election for Florida. I think we've earned it at this point. So we'll take that, right? So let's talk about a little bit about, you know, social engineering schemes, both at work and at home. So many of us are working at home, you're at home, I'm at home. But from a corporate perspective, you know, you work for a huge company with employees all over the world. So how is that being handled? And I'm sure I've heard stories of increased attacks just recently. I don't know if that's because of the election coming up or pandemic, or maybe it's a combination of all of the above, but I've heard recently of increased attacks on corporate entities. So can you talk a little bit about that and what, you know, what you're doing to make sure, you know, you don't have any situations like this at your company?
Well, so business email compromise is probably one of the biggest areas that the hackers have had success. Yeah. And the FBI reported that in 2019, that was a $1.7 billion loss for the United States, over almost 24,000 complaints where corporations were receiving emails from entities that were fake, sometimes impersonating customers or suppliers, saying, here's my invoice. And it looks exactly like what you would normally get from your supplier, but it isn't. It's a fake invoice, but it has the right amount. It may even have the right SKUs or things that you normally purchase. It might even arrive during the same time of the month that it normally comes. And it may look like it's coming from the right email address at that supplier, plus or minus one letter or two. And if you're not paying attention, you might be inclined to pay that invoice in error and have it go to a bad actor. Or they may send you an email saying, oh, because of COVID, our bank is having problems. We've changed our wiring instructions. Could you please send the next payment to this other account? Right. And so that's basically business email compromise. And then obviously the ransomware has gone from just you know, the traditional, I'm going to encrypt your data to, if I can steal it, I may not try to use it to commit identity theft because I think I may make more money simply by holding you hostage. One thing I have seen happen here over 2020 that's not been seen before. In the past, the ransomware thieves would ask for basically a set amount, might be $500, might be $1,000 per machine. But now they are engaging in deep analytics on what your cyber insurance premium costs are.
Oh, wow.
So if your cyber insurance policy will pay out $20 million, they'll ask for $19. So they're being much more sophisticated about how they're asking for money. And then it's more lucrative for them than the hard work of trying to commit identity theft, because the banks have gotten very good at, the minute you see fraudulent charges, they wipe them and can intervene very quickly. But the ransomware is a harder thing to address that way.
I think the email thing is interesting too, because I know I even use, you know, the corporate trainings that you had us go through at Worlds, and now, you know, other companies that I've been with, a lot of companies do that. And I think it really translates to home as well, because, you know, you're getting them in your personal accounts, you're getting them in your Gmail, and they're not always blocked. And sometimes they do look, you know, legitimate. Like you said, it's not just your work email where those things are happening. It's happening in your personal emails as well. I know they try to put filters in place to prevent that, but they get through.
They do. And they're also targeting, unfortunately, elders, senior citizens, people over 60, with the investment fraud, romance fraud, these tech support schemes. Hey, I'm Microsoft. I'm here to fix your computer, or I'm the Social Security Administration, or I'm the IRS. There are over 60,000 complaints like that in 2019, and those losses of $835 million, it's very significant what's happening to people with the same type of approach, and they know what will draw in the elderly people, and as well as students. There's attacks targeting them, and we already talked about the gaming. So cybersecurity is here to stay, and their answer really is for us to become better educated so that we're all aware of how these schemes work.
Yeah, absolutely. A few weeks ago, I had it was interesting. It was AT&T called me. Well, supposedly AT&T called me, and they were asking if I had received my replacement phone, because it had been, you know, they had record of it being shipped. Well, ironically, I had ordered a replacement phone. So I really thought that it was a legitimate call. Fortunately, I didn't give them any type of compromising information. But then I called AT&T because I thought this just seems really strange. So I called AT&T, and sure enough, it was somebody that was trying to, you know, get some information and get another phone shipped out to themselves. So she was explaining to me they were probably recording my voice, and that way then, you know, when they called back, they could actually get a phone, the replacement phone, you know, shipped out to themselves. But it's really, it's scary because, you know, you really, you have to, I'm not elderly. And they caught, you know, and I had to think twice about it because when they called me, you know, it sounded legitimate. And fortunately I didn't give them any information. Nothing was compromised. Nothing bad happened, but you know, if that can happen to me, I feel like that can happen to a lot of people, right? Especially if you don't have the training like I've had, you know, like you have all of the employees go through. So fortunately, I have a little bit of a background in thinking, you know, that kind of tickle on your neck that says something's not right with this, but not everybody does. So, and you want people to be good. You don't want to think that, you know, the people are out there doing nefarious things like that.
One of the most prominent people in the security industry is Bruce Schneier, and he says, amateurs hack systems, professionals hack people. Mm-hmm. And we really are the target. It's much harder to get through systems, much easier to get through people, and time is money. And particularly with the organized crime rings, they're going to go where it's easiest. They have nothing to prove by doing something very difficult or challenging. And so that's usually going to involve some type of social engineering.
Yeah, no, I definitely can understand that. And as somebody that almost fell victim to it myself, I appreciate that it is easy for somebody like me to answer the phone and give you information and then go, wait, what did I just do?
Right. And those phone calls you get that you don't know the number, an unknown caller, they're hiding those. I just encourage everyone, don't answer them. If it's important enough, you'll get a voicemail.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Tim, for individuals, this has been a great conversation, but I do want to kind of wrap up with some advice that you give for individuals that are looking to get into this cybersecurity space. You know, I have individuals ask me, especially college age kids, ask me how do they even get started in this? And so what would you recommend for those that are really looking, what kind of skills do you look for? There's specific certifications or degrees, you know, what would you look for if you're going to hire somebody onto your team?
Well, right now it is an amazingly hot field. I encourage anyone who is on indeed.com, just type in the word cybersecurity, information security, leave the location field blank and see what comes back. You'll see in the midst of all the unemployment that's going on in the United States, hundreds of thousands of openings. This is going to be the issue of our time and the career of our time. And the minute you think you understand it, the threat attack vectors will change. So you're never going to know enough. And so what I'm going to tell you in terms of these certifications, just get your seatbelt on. It's a lifetime of learning. So basically at the pinnacle of the InfoSec world is the CISSP, the Certified Information System Security Professional. And you really can't get it without experience. It's more than just a test. But ISACA has the CISM, the CISA. Those are great starters. CompTIA has Security Plus. And advanced security cert as well. Kali Linux has a great security curriculum. The SANS Institute is probably the best in the country that I've seen in terms of its comprehensive security. It's very expensive. Many universities are trying to build security programs, but the thing is, if you really understand security, you're not teaching it, you're a practitioner. So I'd strongly discourage anyone from just taking an academic only approach to this, but to get into the game by actually getting real world work experience. The security space to really be effective means you have to have a broad understanding of not just the endpoint or development or servers or the cloud. You got to really understand it all to be effective. Whereas if you're just, you know, working in IT, you could be just a network engineer, or just a server or system administrator, or just a programmer. But security has so many facets to it. You need to have a understanding of all of it. And even you see within security now, specialties. But I'd strongly encourage anyone who has a penchant for critical thinking and problem solving, who's cool under fire, who can think under pressure, who's analytic driven. Last year at Black Hat, the keynote speech was every security team will be a development team. Kind of the idea that security is becoming code, as opposed to in the past, it's been more about antivirus or firewalls and appliances. But increasingly, it's a software war. And it's also a data war, given the volume of attacks and the volume of data. And really having an understanding of how to manipulate data and understand data and think critically, those are really the key skills.
Well, and Tim, even when we work together, you know, and I'm sure you still are talking about this, but secure coding, right? And yep. So there's the security side, and then there's also making sure that you do develop secure code so somebody isn't, your network isn't susceptible to some of the code that's been developed internally.
Right. And a lot of the attacks right now are going right at the code, and they're looking to see if you have vulnerabilities. A good starting place for anyone looking to learn about secure code is to go look at the OWASP top 10, OWASWP, OWASP. And, you know, look at the most common vulnerabilities. That's a community of people that are coming together. How can we write better code? And something that every developer should be aware of if you are building particularly web-facing applications.
Well, and I think, Tim, the other thing you said, and it's very true, especially in this space, right? It's just being someone that's interested in continuous learning, because if there's anything, it's trying to stay two steps ahead of the people out there that are going to be, you know, doing things nefariously in your network or trying to get in. So I'm sure that this is an area that you're constantly learning in and just trying to stay ahead of the game as best as you can.
It's no more true than identity. You know, what you're seeing now is that it's not just good to have a strong password. It's almost a requirement. I would say everywhere that you can, we should be encouraging people strongly to use multi-factor authentication. Mm-hmm. If your application offers that, by all means, please use multi-factor authentication. The password, as a species, we're just not good at it. We go with simple. If we make it too hard, we have to write it down, then we forget, and then we change it, but it's not a material change. I think we will see in our lifetime passwordless type of applications that depend upon device trust or keys like YubiKey or things that really take the our ability to remember passwords out of the game. But passwords, I think password keepers like LastPass, good opportunity to keep a lot of different passwords that you can set it once and forget it, and make it super strong, 25, 30 characters. So in some ways, what you're wanting to do is come to a world where you're using the password, but you don't remember or know the password. Mm-hmm. And leverage multi-factor as well, particularly with all of the important apps where your financial data is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a lot of banks are requiring that now. Yeah. So I opened a new bank account recently, and they require that I use, you know, MFA when I'm going and logging in, whether it's from my phone or whether from my computer or whatever. You know, they force you to use it. I didn't even have a choice. I attempted to turn it off, and they wouldn't let me. So I think a lot of any financial institution, like you said, I think is really heading in that direction where you won't even have an option. You're just going to have your multi-factor authentication turned on.
Yeah. And for your investments too, whether it be Fidelity or Schwab or whoever you use, those are really critical, but really everything right now, it's not an inconvenience. It's become much more user-friendly, and it takes the pressure off of that password that is the single thing that stands between an attacker and your information.
Tim, thanks so much. This has been really enlightening, and I think we've covered a lot. Like I said, I think we could probably had a part one and a part two with this because there's just so much ground to cover, especially with not only everything that's gone on, you know, this year, but how quickly this landscape really changes in the cyber world. So thanks for helping us understand it a little bit better. And I look forward to having a future conversation about this as this just landscape continues to change.
Thank you, Courtney.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please take a moment to rate, subscribe, and leave a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.